Hello, I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for joining me. On several occasions since his election, Pope Benedict XVI has reflected on the legacy of the Second Vatican Council. But what were those council years really like? That's what I asked one person reporting on the council for Time magazine. He's well-known author and journalist Robert Blair Kaiser. In a few moments, he'll be giving us an inside look at those landmark years in the history of the Catholic Church, shining the spotlight on the key role the media once played in telling the Church and the world what the Council Fathers were discussing behind the closed doors of St. Peter's Basilica. It was 1962 when 31-year-old Bob Kaiser, fresh out of 10 years in the Jesuits, was assigned to cover the council by Time magazine. He recalls how, at first, his editors were not at all sure whether the council would grab the attention of his magazine's millions of readers. But as it turned out, the event did fuel collective imagination, as the photographs of that epoch portray, bearing witness to a hitherto unknown universality of the Church. Robert Blair Kaiser brings us echoes of that era.
For the first time in all of the Church's history, we saw that the Church was indeed universal. When you saw those cardinals, not only the cardinals, but all those bishops, there were like 2,300 of them, 2,400 by the end of the council, 2,500 maybe. When you saw them coming down the steps of St. Peter's every day at about 12:30, it looked like a waterfall of red and purple and black and so forth. They just kept tumbling down. It was a flow of bishops. They were brown faces and black faces and yellow faces and white faces and ruddy Irish faces.
This universality you describe in such a photographic manner marked a break from the last council back in 1870, in which the council fathers were far more European, no?
In fact, about half of them were from Italy. So it was not considered a kind of ecumenical, meaning worldwide, council. It was a pretty tight little affair. There weren't native African black bishops at that council, for example. But here at Vatican II, there they were. And people like Karl Rahner, the great Jesuit theologian, pointed out in one of his papers that he wrote after the council, this was probably the biggest insight that the Church had, that the Church was indeed universal. It saw itself in a new way.
Not being allowed to be actually physically present in St. Peter's, how did you achieve collecting information?
The trick was, how do you find out what's going on inside when you can't get inside? In fact, everything was sub secreto. They had stamped on every council document sub secreto. They were all in Latin, and they were all marked secret. And the bishops at first didn't know quite how to handle us, members of the press. We were outside waiting for them to come out and tell us what had happened inside.
It was always by hearsay?
Yeah, it was secondhand. Right. Except that a few of us broke the secrecy of the council just by our actions and by getting the bishops to cooperate with us. We would find out who gave the best talks that day, and then we would go to them and say, we understand you gave a great talk today. May we have a copy of it? And they'd give it to us. And we'd have it translated into like six or seven languages and distributed around among us. So our stuff began to appear in some of the great European newspapers and in Time magazine. It was not a Semper Idem kind of church. It was a church. Everything was up for grabs. When the bishops who were there realized that it was a kind of open season here, and that we're here to modernize the church. They used the word aggiornamento, updating. That was Pope John XXIII's favorite word. A word, by the way, that John Paul II only used once in his whole 26 and a half years in office. Updating something that's unchangeable.
But Pope John Paul II spoke in his spiritual testament about the importance of Vatican II and the legacy of Vatican II. He may not have used the word aggiornamento, but he still considered Vatican II as everyone, the great landmark.
Everyone gives lip service to Vatican II, but it's the interpretation of Vatican II that's important. And the current Pope, Benedict XVI, has his own interpretation that is quite at variance with the interpretation that, that I would give it and that a lot of the of those giant cardinals would have given it at the beginning of Vatican II. He was, in fact, Cardinal Frings's assistant. Cardinal Frings made that first brilliant speech. It's quite possible that it was written, or at least helped being written, by none other than young Joseph Ratzinger.
Going back to the popes of the council, how did they follow the events themselves? I mean, John XXIII is said to have followed the council from his TV screen. Did Paul VI adopt the same method?
Yes, he didn't show up.
He watched it on TV.
Watched it on TV also. Right. He wanted to give the fathers the full freedom. And for the first time in the history of the church, and then it stopped, for the first time in the history of the church, we had free speech in the church. And that's what made it so exciting. Because since everything was up for grabs, and people began to realize that they could say what they had in mind for years, but were afraid to say because it looked like it was too revolutionary, they finally said, wow, yeah, we can...
So what do you think were the most revolutionary things that were said at the council?
They wanted to make it a people's church. It was too clerical. So one of their first projects, Schemata, was on the church, and the curia people who had drawn up the draft had put the old pyramidal structure there with the pope at the top and the bishops and then the people, priests and then the people. They switched it around. The people were in Chapter 3 in the original document, but they put the people up in Chapter 1. The people are the main thing. The church would look like a funny place if it didn't have any people in it. It was just composed of priests and bishops and cardinals and popes. So that was the exciting thing. They were trying to make a people's church. I don't know how they did it, because they were all clerics, and here they were trying to give the power and the responsibility to the people. And through the various documents, you can see that that's a stream that runs through all the documents, practically all of the 17. They finally ended up with 17 schemata, not 73. The first one that they did in point of time was a schema on the liturgy, and they debated that for a month. Much of the debate centered around whether they should have the Mass in the language of the people or in the language of the elite, which was Latin. And the Mass had been in Latin, in the Latin Church, in the Western Church, for, 1900 years, huh? Ever since they were doing the recreation of the Last Supper in these house churches in Rome, they did it in Latin. And now all of a sudden, here's Pope John the 23rd and the bishops, the change bishops, wanting to put the Mass in the vernacular, in all the world languages. There was a huge debate over it, and they finally ended up voting on it, and they surprised even themselves when the vote came out, about 2,000 for change and 200 for no change.
Warm thanks there to Robert Blair Kaiser, well-known author and journalist and Rome correspondent for Time magazine in the days of the Second Vatican Council. Thanks for listening. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.